So you've had a giddy round of launches for your knocking the top off a people's history of alcohol. It's been quite exciting for you, hasn't it?
It has. We have gone all over the country. We started off in Brisbane, and that was a personal thrill for me because I love the Saints and I love the go-betweens, and we found all sorts of ways to talk about the Brisbane punk scene and the way that connected with politics in Australia. They sort of had these curious connections through the singer of the Saints, Chris Bailey, his sister Margaret, who had been expelled from every school in Brisbane over a mini skirt, and she ended up, support. I think it was quite influential on her younger brother to be a bit anti-establishment and to sort of help them get gigs. And invariably, they ended up having their own venue in a share house, which they dubbed Club 76. And that was an example of an informal venue, but we were looking at all sorts of different angles, from that sort of informal drinking to the place of pubs in our lives. And so from Brisbane we went all the way to Broken Hill. Don't ask me how that makes sense to be on the journey, but and then to Canberra and Sydney, Melbourne, Hobart next year. So it's all happening.
It's very exciting. And you bring up that site of informal drinking in Brisbane. This book is really quite fascinating because it goes through a whole range of different interesting elements to the Australian history and people's connection to alcohol, but in a academic sense. You take a particular point of view, don't you? There's a strategy in this.
Well, I think we, more than anything, we wanted to take the moralism out of it. Of course, it's a highly moral question. The history of alcohol in Australia is all about people's attitudes to these questions, not just these questions, but if we were to do a book about sex or other sort of, questions like this, of course you have to tussle with that. But I think in a way that sort of thing's obscured. Talking about, I'm kind of surprised that people haven't written about that much about this topic before, given that I think we all kind of feel like alcohol is such a big part of all our lives. Even if you don't drink, it's a part of your life because it's hard to escape. So we wanted to sort of, we didn't want to write a sermon about, that drinking is bad, or on the other side, that you can party your way to revolution. We sort of wanted to, just sort of, get a whole bunch of contributors together and say, well, let's look at it from different angles. And it is a complicated, vexed question because often the most useful aspects of alcohol as a socializer, as something that makes you feel good, that can bring people together, can also tear people apart, can make you feel awful, can, really run things off the rails. So I think, we all kind of know that, but actually having, a bunch of historians go away and research a whole bunch of topics from, right from invasion to early colonial days to the story we had last year when the anti-fascist bartender spat in the beer at the Irish pub. We've covered 200 plus years of stories and tried to really give a rounded, varied picture of how alcohol fits into social lives, economic lives as well, for that matter.
Well, it's like those groundbreaking studies that say took a commodity like coal or any commodity and then explored the social and economic realities that are connected to it. But you've also done something else. You've decided to do it from the point of view of the working class and those who and that, of course, then brings in class struggle, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, there is that, we called it a people's history. I guess maybe we could have called it a radical history, but there's a great tradition of that term, people's history. people would know Howard's in his classic book about American history that went through that lens. And, you know, there's kind of enough books written about kings and queens and prime ministers and lawyers, you know, often when we win something progressive, there'll be a lawyer quick to take credit. But we know very well, listeners to this program, that it is ordinary people and people power organizing that get these things. And they're often not the people who have their stories told. So, yeah, it's very much the framework. And the way that I like to explain the idea of people's history is that it's sort of the window that you choose to look out of a building. So I imagine a pub, and you could imagine, you know, just where in Melbourne, you can, on the corner of Flinders Street and Swanston Street, Young and Jackson, you know, this grand pub. If you looked out the nicest window, what do you see? You see beautiful church, and you see everything, you know, well manicured, and you see the best of everything. But what happens if you choose to look out of a different window? You look out the back window into the alleyway, and you see the people, the workers rolling in the kegs, and you might see in a previous 100 years ago or whatever, you might have seen sex workers plying their trade, or SP bookies, or homeless people, or you see the more a more rounded picture of life, the people that are marginalised, the people who actually do the work. So, yeah, that's our approach to history with this book. I'm sure that, you know, John Elliott and these big barons of the brewery industry, or people who own a lot of pubs, they often have their stories told. And here's a chance for us to tell the stories of the barmaids who, you know, fought for better working conditions and, you know, were chasing scabs out of those pubs in Broken Hill when we were there. I very much enjoyed telling that story, pouring pepper onto the meals of scabs who are breaking their picket line. So, yeah, we've uncovered all sorts of things like that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. In fact, this book is full of absolutely astounding little known facts. One of them that just took my breath away was that Joseph Stalin was on the front of the Women's Weekly.
Yeah, I mean, we did cover quite a bit about the early Communist Party. I mean, I suppose it's a period of promise. It doesn't really matter in some senses what happened to the Communist Party. But when you think about all those early people who, you know, they'd seen what had happened in Russia, they saw the, you know, workers' power there. And, yeah, there was... I was particularly interested in the Bohemian connections, because then, as now, you know, a lot of people who are interested in arts and who are sort of forward thinking in music and film and art, they take an interest in social equality. And so no surprise that in Melbourne as well, people would meet at the often the sort of Italian continental sort of styled cafe bistros. And this is when, you know, it was almost illegal to get a wine. You know, they'd have to have vases on the table so in case the licensing inspector came, they could tip the wine in. But those early reds and radicals would rub shoulders there. And I think that, you know, it's hard to actually evaluate poor decisions that were made, but clearly they were talking and reimagining a better world. So we used that story to also then get into the nitty-gritty of, well, what happened to the Communist Party? And you get all the, you know, we looked at people like Noel Coonahan, the artist who did some really heroic things, like the, you know, being in the free speech cage up in Brunswick, and he used to go around Australia with Judah Watton cartooning people, and he'd meet people in the pubs and sort of pay his way through that. You know, he was someone who was, yeah, as a Stalinist, and but, you know, started off in a very different sort of journey. So you get all the way up to that curious point during Second World War when Joseph Stalin is on the cover of Women's Weekly because he was an ally of the Australian government. So, you know, the communists were sort of at times quite accepted, but at times you know, the worst enemies in Australia, hounded by ASIO, and also at times just sort of the, these eccentric bohemians that you'd see sort of in line with the modernist artists.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I thought it was fascinating, the picture of William Lane as well. He was a fairly unattractive character, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, very popular, which is quite astounding for us, given that the book is about alcohol. But of course, he wanted to talk about people who did not like alcohol at all. So William Lane fits into that picture. He wanted to, you know, he didn't like capitalism, but he basically, he didn't want to have a revolution. He didn't want to bother with all that. He wanted to just set up a new society from scratch in the society we live in today. Now, a lot of people have tried communes, and there's a lot of debate about whether this is possible. His approach was to actually get a massive sailing ship, fill the sailing ship, try to entice people to come, go all the way to South America and form a new society there on, you know, a sort of new socialist-ish society. And they called it New Australia, and New Australia in Paraguay, of all places. And, you know, we like to think that socialism will be about equality and freedom of choice and sort of these sorts of things. But there were two main rules which really got in the way of William Lane's designs. And that was, William Lane did not want alcohol at all. So there was a ban on alcohol. And he was absolutely racist to the core. He did not want people fraternizing with the locals. So inevitably, this experiment collapsed very quickly because people did want to drink and they did want to, go across the color boundaries and talk to the people who were their neighbors. So, we take a very, we examine the people within the left and different projects because it wasn't all rosy. And, certainly there's a, there's some utopian projects in there for better or worse. And, I guess our approach is, like, let's look at everything. Let's throw it all on the table. And maybe out of that, we'll sort of see, well, where do we want to go from here as well? What are the projects and the strategies which have really worked for us? And we've used sort of stories around alcohol to do that. But, also just to, have a rolling good read through Australian history, really.
Yeah, and it does. It also uncovers a whole range of really interesting things that I didn't know. Things like the a role that the women's temperance movement had in championing the rights of Aboriginal women, and how the federal group of organising for women's rights fell into line with the notion that assimilation was the way to go. That was really interesting.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because I think probably a lot of us know the word wowser. That sort of entered the Australian vernacular even today. But, you know, that kind of was invented 100 years ago, and that word was basically ridiculing the anti-alcohol forces, you know, also the forces that didn't like, you know, made people wear full suits when they went swimming at the beach, these sorts of, so there was an element of that. But there has always been a sort of left force within within society who was like, no, you know, there's obviously some people cannot handle alcohol, and there's some real problems with this, particularly in certain marginalized communities that are already dealing with a lot of stresses in life. So, you know, the Aboriginal population that was clearly one of those. So, yeah, the Women's Christian Temperance Union has a curiously very progressive role in a whole number of areas. So, we tried to cover that very respectfully and kind of reassert the contribution that some of those people made. And it's not all one way, like particularly with Aboriginal politics. So you have that contradiction, which is elsewhere, where if you're banned to drink, a civil right demand will be like, well, no, we want to have a social life like anyone else. So, you know, with Gary Foley's oral history, he covers that a lot about, well, no, we sort of want the right to go into pubs as well. But, you know, similarly, Maggie Brady, in her piece in the book, she covers Aboriginal communities, a sort of confrontational temperance approach. Like, no, we want to drive alcohol out. We're seeing all these problems in the community. So, yeah, not easy, but reading these sort of various case studies can, I guess, help navigate a path in one's own specific context to figure out, well, what should the next steps be?
Yeah, and because this book talks about legislation, strikes, it also talks about, so big actions of that sort, it also goes out of its way to have little pictures of actual people, and that's really nice. And one of them that was really interesting was Celia Shelley. She was a very interesting person.
Yes, a tigress of trades hall. I mean, how could we not have a chapter on someone with probably the best nickname in all of Australian political history? So, yeah, she was a woman unionist, was in her position for many years and took a very confrontational, militant approach. You know, it is a story that we tell sort of over and over again in the book that, you know, for people in the liquor industry in various ways, whether they're serving the drinks in a pub or they're picking the grapes in a vineyard or they're transporting the beer, you know, people want decent wages and conditions. And there's inevitably a tension there because the bosses get their profits from grinding those workers down and trying to get them to work longer, harder, for less. And so this is, you know, from the beginnings of capitalism in Australia, an ongoing tension that exists today. So,
there's two things about her is that she was from Perth, and also she was the first paid female union secretary.
Yes. So, and we wanted to cover, we wanted to cover like women in particular, and we wanted to cover Perth. So there's geographic spread. But, her story is really fascinating and cuts across a bunch of the different political movements that were around at the time. And, yeah, not easy navigating that period. But, in terms of another, vignette of a unionist, we covered Chicka Dixon, who was the, quite a significant Aboriginal activist in Sydney. He was someone who was sort of a reformed alcoholic, and he worked as the wharfie in the maritime industry. So, yeah, we tried to cover different angles there, and union officials, but also rank and file workers. So, one of the more recent pieces about union politics was about the Melbourne Liquor Distribution Centre strike that happened just a couple of years ago. And that was a wildcat strike, which means that it's the workers doing it, from the shop floor by themselves, self-organising, and, yeah, quite a heroic campaign. So that was a good one too. And we managed to get a few pictures in there, which is always good. And so I think people will be pleasantly surprised about some of those lesser known stories of workplace resistance, whether it's Celia Shelley or going all the way up to a more recent militant wildcat strike.
Well, you've just touched on something. There's lots of pictures.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like half the work of the book was just in getting the pictures together. We really tried to find stuff that people hadn't seen before and it just can really enliven a story. And, particularly with this topic about people's social lives, those pictures can fall away from importance. They sort of linger in people. They're very precious to people, but it might not be the iconic photos that you see in politics. So, yeah, just sort of doing a bit of detective work to dust those off and put them in the book. Like, it's really just really pleasing that we were able to do that and to make a book that's really attractive. Like, we wanted it to be, it's history. There's 67 pieces in this book. It's substantial, but some of the pieces are just one-page spreads, or some of the pieces are full of the photos, and they help guide you through and really bring it to life. And we sort of had the idea that this would be a way for people that don't often read history to sort of get into it. It's a relatable topic. It's something that you could buy for a parent or, you know, a younger sibling as a sort of entry point into politics, because there's sort of well-known stories, but finding a way, a vehicle through alcohol to sort of discuss big political issues, whether that's, you know, the Wavehill walk-off and Aboriginal rights or union campaigns. So, and of course, you know, pictures help the medicine go down, so we try to get as much of them in there as possible.
Yeah, well, it explains a really lot about a whole lot of things. So, because it covers a lot of territory. White Australian history is pretty short, so in fact it's quite handy for a book of this sort, but it gives us a view to why things are here now, and people have forgotten why a beer garden exists, for example, that type of stuff. It's really quite fascinating. So on a whole lot of levels, it talks about attitudes, it talks about what's actually here now and why it's here now, and also about ongoing struggle. There's going to be a launch in Melbourne.
Oh, I just can't wait for it. It's going to be, I mean, we had to choose somewhere that had a great storied history with the left. So, of course, we chose the John Curtin Hotel, that would be familiar to many of the listeners. And that's across the road from Trades Hall. It's been there for 100 plus years. And, yeah, that's going to be on Saturday, the 9th of December at 4 p.m. And, yeah, we've got Gary Foley speaking at it. We've got Jeff Sparrow, great writer. We've got Ian McIntyre. We've got Julie Kimber from Recorder and the NTU and from the Melbourne Labor History Branch. She'll be launching it formally. We're just so excited to have Julie do that for us. Jeff and Gary's stories are in the book, and Ian will tell us more about his contribution as well.
I'll have to say before I let you go that it was slightly hilarious to know that John Curtin, who was an alcoholic, was in charge of curtailing drinking hours and alcohol flow during the Second World War.
I do feel like the John Curtin Hotel really should be next to the Harold Holt Pool. That's sort of one of those Melbourne absurdities, which I love. So we hope we can pack it out. So I hope everyone listening comes along and spreads the word. We just another word on it. I mean, we ran this book as a not-for-profit, and it's through the Publisher Interventions, which is also a not-for-profit. So everyone donated their time, and we're sort of all want to, there's not that many, you know, left history books coming through. And so we all just want everyone to get behind it and to share their stories, and sort of from this one, we can build some more. So it's been really pleasing so far going around the country and doing all these launches. And I'm just ecstatic that I get to finish the year off in Melbourne, launching it in front of my hometown.
Thanks for talking to me, Alex.
Thanks, Annie. Bye.
Bye.